Gene Pasale, and this is Living History. This show explores the rich heritage of the Brandywine Valley outside Philadelphia, focusing on the people, places, and events over more than 300 years which have played an important part in our American heritage. Each show highlights a local town, event, or personality who's had a notable influence on our culture. Before we get started, I wanted to mention that our call-in line, if you have questions or comments, is 610-701-9243. That's 610-701-9243. This day in history, April 6th. In 1862, the Battle of Shiloh begins with Union forces under General Ulysses S. Grant opposing Confederate General Albert Sidney Johnston near Pittsburgh Landing, Tennessee, a conflict which was one of the bloodiest events of the Civil War, with thousands of casualties, including Johnston, who became the highest-ranking officer on either side to be killed during the four-year struggle that eventually claimed over 600,000 lives. In 1896, the first modern Olympic Games are held in Athens, more than two millennia after the original four-year cycle. The restarted Games included only 13 nations, but would grow to encompass athletes from nearly 200 different countries. In 1968, a groundbreaking film startles audiences around America. 2001, A Space Odyssey, brought viewers into a new dimension with realistic space and time travel, and a thinking, talking computer with devious intentions. And in 1970, Sam Shepard dies after a tumultuous two decades during which he would be tried and convicted for the 1954 murder of his wife in their Bay Village, Ohio home, an event which later caught the attention of attorney F. Lee Bailey, who successfully petitioned the Supreme Court for a retrial in which Shepard was found not guilty. His story is suspected as providing the material for the hugely popular TV series The Fugitive. Today in America, it's become clear that many people just don't know much about history. Some say it was because they had a boring history teacher in grade school. Others maintain that it's just too many dates and battles. Through shows like Water's World, where people are interviewed about some very basic facts of American history, it's sadly true that millions of Americans don't know the most fundamental things concerning their own heritage. At least one person is doing an outstanding job to change all that. Dr. Mark Bowles is a professor of history at American Public University, APU. He came to my attention when I started my master's degree program in American history at the school. I took a graduate seminar with him, which was not only interesting, but an excellent review of more than 200 years of our heritage. Dr. Bowles has a wide range of interests, from the history of science, NASA and the space program, and even rowing across the Atlantic Ocean. Last year, he co-authored the book Just Keep Rowing with Katie Spotts, who was the youngest woman to row solo across that vast expanse of water. She did it for water. Katie and Mark are bringing attention to the dire need for clean water facilities for hundreds of millions of people around the world who suffer from the lack of this precious resource. Mark is currently on a speaking tour to showcase this important cause. He's written a total of 14 books on a variety of topics. And with all that, he's found the time to be with us today. Mark, welcome to the show.
Gene, thanks so much for the introduction. And it's pretty cool to share an anniversary with Stanley Kubrick in 2001, one of my favorite all-time movies.
I love that film. That's a great movie. How long have you been teaching at APU, and how long have you focused on history?
Well, I've been at APU as a full-time professor of history since 2009. Prior to that, I spent 10 years just focused on public history through two history companies that I helped found, one History Enterprises, and the other one, which is still going on, it's called Bell History, and kind of kicked off my career in 1999 when I finished my PhD in history at Case Western Reserve University here in Cleveland.
Yeah, Case Western is known as an outstanding science school. I actually knew a few people who went there. You teach about several different topics in history. Just tell us a little bit about the range of your classes.
Sure. My expertise is in the history of science and technology, so you actually are just starting a new course in that with me as of yesterday, so you'll get your feet wet in that. History of science European, it's mostly European science since 1700. But I also teach American history, as you said, the seminar class, which focuses on 200 years and many, many books that you get to read of U.S. history. I specialize mostly, my time period in U.S. history, I mostly specialize in 20th century United States history. And then I also teach historiography, which is one of my favorite subjects. It's a word that most people don't know, but historiography means the history of history writing. And so we focus on just the historians and how they've changed interpretations of past important events over time.
Yeah, I remember when I first saw the word historiography, I'm thinking, did they make this up? Is this a new word to talk about something important in history? And for the casual listener, historiography is basically how historians have written about history over history. So Right. Over the last several thousand years, it is how historians have viewed events and people and places and things like that. Do you have a personal favorite period in American history?
Well, like I said, science and technology is what I gravitate to. So that covers just about any period in time you can imagine, from the ancient Greeks to the present. But for U.S. history, most of my work has been done in the Cold War period, World War II to the present. I'm kind of a present guy. Mm-hmm. I love the 20th century, and the Cold War is pretty fascinating because one of my other interests is the history of computing. And, of course, that just a couple things happened in the history of computing since 1945.
You mentioned a strong focus on science. Do you have any favorite scientists over the last few hundred years? Anybody that really rises to the top of your list?
Well, Newton has got to be on the top of my list. Isaac Newton was just a remarkable, remarkable intellect, co-discovering calculus, for one, a subject that I struggled with in college. And here's this guy that invented it. So that was always, he always piqued my interest. And he had such a wide range of interests. I mean, it wasn't just science. It wasn't just the law of gravity that he uncovered. But he also actually spent more time writing about religion than he did science, something that very few people know about him. Mm-hmm. He was very interested in alchemy. So it was just, he had so many talents. And I think why he's important today is too often scientists have this narrow, narrow focus and specialization. And you go back a couple hundred years and you can just see scientists that had a broad breadth of understanding and interest, and they weren't constrained to just one subject.
Yes, and in Newton's time, I believe they called it natural philosophy.
Right. Science. There were no scientists. Mm-hmm. There were no scientists until the 19th century, actually, mm-hmm. Which is pretty remarkable when you think about it. But yeah, they were natural philosophers, and so that kind of gave them the opportunity to pick and choose various areas to explore.
You mentioned Newton. A lot of people say, well, Newton was a genius, but clearly Albert Einstein was a genius. I remember getting into a discussion a few years back, and somebody said, well, who is more brilliant, Einstein or Newton? Well, they were both incredibly brilliant. I'm not sure how you can rate the two. I don't know what your thoughts on that, but...
Right, you can't really rate it, although this goes back to one of my favorite episodes in Star Trek The Next Generation, on the holodeck, where they got to play poker with great scientists in the past, and I believe they had Newton, Einstein, and playing together. And so I don't know who actually won the card match, but you flip a coin as far as who was more brilliant. Both yeah. were equally significant as far as what they did for the history of science.
Mm-hmm. Now, now that we're talking about history and in America, who's your favorite president?
Well, it's funny you mentioned about people not liking history. I despised history when I was in high school, and it was for exactly the reason that you mentioned. I didn't care about the history of dead white politicians, and mm-hmm. I didn't much care to memorize dates. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I got to college and I was forced to take what I thought would be my final history class with mm-hmm. Eminent historian Dr. George Knepper. He was an Ohio historian. Mm-hmm. That I realized, wait a minute, I might just have a passion for history. How could that possibly be? Mm. So that being said, that disclaimer, I am aware there are American presidents, and I should know more about them. But yeah, my favorite president, I'd have to go with FDR. I think most American historians locate him on the top three of their list. But just the fact that he went through four terms, not quite through his fourth term, but and two very different, very significant world crises with the Great Depression and World War II. it ranks him up there with just what he had to deal with, along with a physical disability as well.
Oh, sure. Yeah, and you know, the interesting thing is, well, a lot of people today who actually don't know this, the press at the time tried to photograph him with either some kind of a desk or a barrier in front of him, so you couldn't tell he was either in a wheelchair or with hand braces. And
exactly.
Some people didn't even know that he was seriously impaired.
Right. Imagine today all of the newscasters, all of the press, social media, all agreeing to not do something together. It would be unheard of. But yeah, they didn't want to show a United States president in a weakened condition for what it might mean for the rest of the world. So that they helped keep his secret.
Mm-hmm. You've co-authored a fascinating book with Katie Spotts, Just Keep Rowing. How did you connect with Katie?
Yeah, I was a huge fan of hers during her row. And just a point of clarification, you said she was the youngest woman to row across an ocean. She's the youngest person of either sex to row across an ocean, which she did at age 22.
Mm.
And that was back in 2010. So I was a fan of hers. I realized that she was doing this in the middle of her row. She was actually tweeting and sending out blog posts from the middle of the ocean completely alone, no chase boat or anything.
Yeah.
And I started following along. I said, this was the most amazing story I've read about, you know, in many years. And then a couple years after the row, she happened to post to Facebook that she was looking for someone to help her write a book. And so I basically just sent her an email and said, hey, let's get together for lunch. And we seemed to click. And about a year and a half later, we were able to publish our book.
It's interesting. You know, doesn't she live in the same general region where you live in Ohio?
Yeah, she lives about an hour away from me up in Lakewood, Ohio. She's originally from Mentor, Ohio, and I'm down about an hour south here around the Akron, Ohio vicinity. So it was relatively easy for us to meet up.
Mm-hmm.
And she was actually running a race in the Cuyahoga Valley National Park about 2 days after I first contacted her, and that's about 5 minutes away from me. So it was very easy for us to get together.
Oh, interesting. I've actually read Just Keep Rowing. It's a fascinating book. It's an excellent book, really. Very inspirational. We've got less than a minute here but before we take our break, but have you received much feedback on the book?
I received a lot of feedback, and it's interesting because the head of Sherwin-Williams just recently read the book. He took the book with him on a round-the-world tour, and he said it made an excellent companion with the life lessons in the book. And then a friend of mine, his daughter, he works at NASA. He has an 11-year-old daughter. And he said his 11-year-old daughter keeps reading the book over and over again and would I mind sending him a signed copy. So we've got this spectrum of people that I think the book speaks to, and that's what makes me most happy.
It is really a fascinating book because each chapter is kind of an inspirational message. And as I was reading it, I was thinking, this is a great story. We're going to just take a brief break. But stay with us. We will be back with Mark Bowles on Living History.
Honey, we need a springtime getaway.
A springtime getaway. Somewhere with
amazing food.
Amazing food. And
cozy couples lodging.
Right, but not too far away or
Gettysburg.
Gettysburg.
Yep, Gettysburg.
Okay, but I want
award-winning golf
courses.
Horseback riding. A firkin festival.
How do you know all of this?
They have an app.
They have an app?
Yep, at destinationgettysburg.com.
So, Gettysburg.
Yep. Gettysburg.
Gettysburg, PA. Make your own history.
Are you tired of looking up at that old, streaky, stained, tired, ugly roof? Tired of that ugly roof taking away from your home's curb appeal? G.P. Martini Roofing wants to solve your curb appeal woes with a new roof built with Atlas Pristine Shingles featuring Scotch Guard Protector from 3M. The only shingle with a lifetime limited warranty against algae streaks and stains. G.P. Martini's crews are highly trained professional installers of asphalt shingle roofs, and now with the power of Atlas Shingles and Scotchgard Protector from 3M, GP Martini will install a roof that will provide the lasting color you choose for as long as you're in your home. Let GP Martini Roofing have a look at that nagging leak, or just call to consult about upgrading the look for your prized investment. Call them today, 610-873-1696. Whether your need is residential or commercial, GP Martini Roofing has the expertise in-house to solve your problem, or to simply make your home or office look its best. 610-873-1696. That's the number to call. 610-873-1696. And one of those GP Martini trucks will be on its way to you.
WCHE 1520 AM. Local news at the top of each hour and updated whenever news breaks, including on our Facebook page and our website, WCHE1520.com.
I'm Gene Pasale, and this is Living History. Today we're talking with Dr. Mark Bowles, a professor of history at American Public University. Mark, you've written quite a few books, including the co-authorship of Just Keep Rowing with Katie Spotts. It's a fascinating book about rowing across the Atlantic. Most people would consider such a feat not only impossible, but highly treacherous and life-threatening. She must have a burning passion about this cause. Has Katie been involved in events around the world to bring attention to the cause of clean water?
Yeah, she's really devoted much of her life to this, and she does it through a very interesting way, not just speaking about it, but actually doing these extreme events to help bring attention. First of all, she loves to push herself, and she loves endurance challenges. And she's done things like swim the entire length of the Allegheny River. That's 325 miles, and no human on Earth has ever done that besides her. She's biked across the United States. She's run through the Mojave Desert by herself. She's done a 62-mile ultramarathon in Australia. That's 62 miles all in one day. So she does all this, and then she links each of these activities to helping a specific school or several schools get clean water in areas in which water is very, very diseased. And so she does this through a nonprofit group called H2O for Life. They're based in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and they have schools throughout the world that need support and need help. And if you're interested in helping support a specific place in this world, you can go to h2oforlifeschools.org and learn about their mission.
Excellent. You've also been an advocate of getting involved with your community with groups like the Rotary Club. I've personally spoken at many Rotary meetings with my historical lecture series. How much have you been involved with Rotary?
Really just recently, in the past four, five, 6 months, giving speaking tours. I've been to 20 different groups and given talks at them and learned a lot about what Rotary is about. You know, it's amazing. It's a 110-year-old organization. It's in 200 countries around the world. There's 1.2 million members. And I think that it's important because people really are not, as a rule, getting involved in civic organizations today like they used to be. Look at Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone. And he talks about this disconnect from each other physically. I mean, we're connecting more in social media, but we don't know our neighbors as much as we used to. We don't join local clubs. And I think it's an important part of being a citizen, and we get a lot out of actually connecting with our local population.
I absolutely agree. You know, when I was in grade school, we did have a course called civics. Today, if you ask a 12-year-old what civics means, they'd probably be dumbfounded. But do you think our schools need to kind of return to the basics and kind of get people more in tune with being active in their community, active in their environment?
Well, I have a 15-year-old daughter and two 7-year-old twins. If I asked them what civics meant, they would say it would be a group of Honda cars, a Civic. I drive a Civic, so that's the only reason they would even know that name.
I like the Accord, yeah. By the way.
Okay. That's a little step up. That's more too rich for me. But, yeah, I do think that we do need to return to the basics in some respects, but not just a blind return to the basics of what civics was during the Cold War, which was, you know, citizenship and how to be a good voter. We need to look at civics today within the digital landscape and how to be a global citizen in this digital world where not only can we interact with the people next door, but we can just as easily interact with someone from India or a foreign country and what that means as far as being a representative of the United States and also respectful of other people's beliefs and culture.
I agree with that completely. You know, you probably know the term the global village. I believe it was Marshall McLuhan.
Right.
That is a direct link to the topic that you're discussing. Getting back to Rotary just for a second, has the Rotary Club supported any clean water projects?
Absolutely. They're a huge supporter of Katie during her row. It was the Chagrin Valley Rotary Club here in Ohio. And they did fundraising, helped her support her row. The Rotary Club of Dakar, South Africa, helped to launch Katie from their shores. And the Rotary Club in French Guyana was the one that received her on the other side of the Atlantic. So the Rotary was in just so important through every aspect of the planning, sending and the receiving and welcoming her back.
Oh, fascinating. You've written several different books, several on the history of science, NASA and related topics, science and culture, realizing the dream of flight, NASA's nuclear frontier. Were there any common themes in those books?
Uh, Yeah, well, science obviously was the common theme through all of them. Spent a lot of time with NASA and looking at their programs from a historical standpoint. Science in Flux is the name of the book that I wrote about NASA's only nuclear reactor that it ever built. And they did this at a NASA facility called Plum Brook here in Ohio. Most people aren't familiar with it, but if you've seen the movie The Avengers, and you remember when Loki came down to Earth, he actually came down to Earth at a specific location at Plum Brook. It's the largest vacuum chamber in the world, and it's called the Space Power Facility. So that was kind of the place where I wrote Science in Flux. But Science in Flux is that we're not giving enough long-term support to science from the government. And that was the problem with the nuclear reactor. It was only funded for 10 years. And then the political winds changed and our mission changed. And so this fantastic nuclear reactor never got to achieve its glory and its dream. So kind of a common theme throughout many of my books is that we need to support science. We need to support science away from tying it to political funding, like through NASA. And we need to look at long-term big science projects, because they do pay off.
I definitely agree. You wrote a book honoring the 100th anniversary of the Wright Brothers flight. What insights did you gain from that research?
Yeah, that was actually an edited collection, so it was an amazing job that we got. It was myself and another historian, Virginia Dawson. We co-founded History Enterprises, a public history company, together. NASA came to us and they said, we would like you to put together a book commemorating the 100th anniversary of the Wright Brothers flight and find noted scholars who will write biographical chapters on key people throughout the past 100 years of flight. So it was a great opportunity to develop a conference around it, and then eventually we have the book. And that is, you can download that for free from my website if you're interested in it. But it's about dreaming big. I mean, that's the title, Realizing the Dream of Flight. Dream big and devote yourself to passions in life, whether it was just flying an airplane for the first time or going to the moon. But that's one of the things that we humans do the best at is dreaming and attempting to realize those dreams and succeeding. Success or failure, sometimes it doesn't even matter. It's just putting ourselves out there and striving for excellence is what's important and what makes us human.
I agree completely. My father was an aerospace engineer, so I have a particular interest in aviation. I've been down to Kitty Hawk in North Carolina, where the Wright brothers conducted their experiments. Did you spend much time at Kitty Hawk?
Not much. I went as a kid, but been to other NASA centers like Kennedy Space Center, Langley Research Center. Langley was the very first NASA center. It was actually NACA before there was even a NASA. NASA emerged out of the Cold War right after the Sputnik shocked the nation, and the United States realized that we needed more than an aeronautical agency, which NACA was, and they spun NACA into NASA in 1958 because of that. And I spent most of my time here at Glenn Research Center here in Ohio, where I did most of my research.
By the way, for our listeners, if you want to learn a little bit about this story on Sputnik and NASA, et cetera, there was a movie that came out several years ago called October Sky. I believe wonderful movie. I think it's Jake Gyllenhaal, one of his earliest movies. Excellent movie about the early space program. You've taken a strong interest in NASA and the history of rocket-powered aviation. What brought you to that topic? I mean, did you meet any astronauts? I mean, what was the specific link with that?
It would be Carl Sagan. When I was a kid, Carl Sagan and his series on PBS called Cosmos is what, you know, again, I didn't much like science in when I was a kid either. I guess I didn't like much when I was a kid. I don't know. But I would anxiously await the next episode every Sunday night on PBS, and Carl Sagan just inspired me to love the idea of what science could be about. It's, again, it's about dreaming big, about big things. And at the same time, the NASA flybys with the unmanned rockets like Voyager and Viking and Pioneer were speeding off into the solar system and returning these amazing photos of the planets And so that is really what inspired my passion for not only space, but also science.
Yeah, that, you mentioned the flybys of our satellites. When I was in graduate school at the University of Texas at Austin back in 1980, one of my professors, who was a tectonics professor, he studied the structure of the Earth. He was very big into space travel, what they called the Jupiter flyby, I believe, at the time, which was images taken by one of our space probes exploring the solar system. The images are fascinating. I believe one of them actually showed volcanoes going off on the surface of the planet, which was just spectacular. What are some of your favorite topics in spaceflight? I mean, what kinds of things fascinate you the most?
Well, certainly these unmanned probes, and I got to write about them through one of my books. It was called Taming Liquid Hydrogen, and this was a history of the Centaur rocket. Most people don't know about the Centaur rocket, but it played a vital role in all of these projects. The Centaur rocket is what's known as a second-stage rocket. It sits on top of the Atlas rocket, and on top of the Centaur, then, actually goes the unmanned probe. So the Vikings sat on top of Centaur. The Atlas detaches first. And the Centaur pushes the unmanned probe even further, faster, higher, and then it detaches it and sends the probe on its way. So in the book Taming Liquid Hydrogen, I got to write about each of these programs and the history of these unmanned flybys. So that really is what is interested me the most. Space shuttle, of course, is fascinating. That could be a whole other topic for another day, but low Earth orbit is one thing, but actually getting out into the planets is a whole different ballgame.
I agree. You know, nearly every American over the age of 50 remembers Neil Armstrong's walk on the moon on July 20th, 1969. Yet after the Apollo missions ended, many people seem to lose interest in spaceflight. Tell us, in terms of your view, why it's important for the U.S. to remain committed to space travel and exploration.
Yeah, I wish I had 2 hours to talk about this because I'm very, very passionate about it. But I'm going to give you three quick answers. One is philosophical, one is practical, and the other is scientific. Philosophically, and I'm going to sound like Star Trek again, but philosophically, it's what we're meant to do as humans. We're meant to cross oceans. We're meant to sail across oceans. We're meant to row across oceans. We're meant to climb mountains and to explore. We have a natural something inside of us that wants to see what's beyond the bend in the river ahead of us. And that is what space represents to us as a human race. We need to explore the unknown. Practically, though, I mean, it does have tremendous practical benefits. And go to spinoffs.nasa.gov. I won't go through the hundreds of them, but if you go to that, you can see the technology that we use on a daily basis, which you would have no idea came from NASA. And then finally, from a scientific perspective, we need to understand science. Science is who we are. We need to understand our climate. We need to understand our Earth. We need to understand our Earth's past and its present and future and where the Earth came from in terms of the solar system. And that's what NASA helps us to do. So philosophically, practically, scientifically, NASA is vital to our nation. And it only represents 0.5%, 1% of our federal budget, only $17 billion a year. And it's the best $17 billion that we spend as a nation.
Fascinating. You know, in terms of the future of spaceflight, do you think we'll ever set up colonies on the moon or even Mars within our lifetime?
Well, yeah, that's the key qualification, within our lifetime. I'm a historian, so I get hindsight. I get that 2020 hindsight into the past, and we don't often look to the future. Obviously, I'm convinced we will at some point in your or my lifetime. I don't know about that. Mars One is an interesting attempt in the Netherlands to do this sort of attempt to send two people at a time to Mars and then slowly send two more people each year. We'll see if that works. I don't think we're quite there technologically yet, but I'm fascinated to see what will happen because our future is in space.
Excellent. I want to mention that Mark has a website, ProfessorMDB.com, and also Bell History, B-E-L-L-E, History.com, which lists his impressive bio, his many books, which are available there, and also on Amazon.com. So if you want to get his books through Amazon, you can. His site also lists the various activities and events he participates in around the country. And by the way, for those NASA fans, you can actually download some of the NASA books from his site at no charge. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today for the show. Be sure to tune in next week, Wednesday, April 13, 2016, at 1 p.m. Eastern, when we'll be speaking with Neil Hobbins of the historic Mill at Anselma. one of the oldest fully restored functioning gristmills in the Philadelphia region. Thank you all for tuning in today for Living History.